Good morning, everybody, and TGIF, TGIDF. Thank goodness it's Divorce Friday.
It's the first time that I hear you messing this one up.
I like that.
Hopefully I'm the one.
Right, yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this episode of Divorce Friday. It's a podcast that addresses your financial questions about divorce. So I'm Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner in the CDFA in Newton. And you are, Diane?
I'm Diane Pappas, and I'm a certified divorce financial analyst and also a certified quadro specialist. And I am in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And we have our guest speaker here today. Chris, excellent. Would you like to introduce him?
Sure. So we have a special guest. He's David Callum. So David is a lawyer and a mediator in Hingham. And I think his law firm is called, Callum Mahoney. Is that correct?
That's correct. Callum Mahoney Family Law and Mediation.
And mediation. Okay. And
mediation. Yes.
So as part of our fall series on child support, David will help us figure out how we determine income for child support purposes. It's a complicated topic, and that's why we need someone like David for that. So for the attendees, if you found us on Facebook, please do like our page on Facebook. If you found that through Twitter, do like us on Twitter also. And so on Twitter, we're at Divorce Friday. And on Facebook, if you search for Divorce Friday, you will find it also. And in the meantime, if you want to put your questions on the Facebook page, we'll be getting to them and make sure to answer them. Probably not during this broadcast, but after that. You can also email us at divorcefriday@gmail.com. And divorcefriday@gmail.com goes to both Diane and I. And you can also go to the website, divorcefriday.com, where the podcast will be published also. So at this time, maybe it is time to start talking about income in child support. So the reason that we do that, Diane, why do we talk about child support this fall?
Well, for one thing, the reason why is because every 4 years, the child support guidelines are federally mandated that they have to be reviewed. So we have a task force in Massachusetts that does that every 4 years. And the result of that task force, and that takes about a year or so, are the new 2021 child support guidelines. And so there are some changes. There are a few significant changes. Income is one of them, but income is the first thing that we always talk about with child support because it's the first question that people always ask. They want to know, what is my child support going to be? What am I going to have to pay? And the biggest question that we have as financial people that are involved in this is, how are we going to calculate this income? Because if we can't decide how to calculate the income and come to an agreement, which in a litigated case, you're going to fight about the income most likely, in mediation and other ways of doing this outside of the court system, we can try to come to an agreement. Because the earlier that we can agree on what income to use, the better we are able to move forward. Right, David?
Absolutely. And income, you know, in situations where both people have a job, they get a paycheck and they get a W-2 and there are no extra fancy benefits, it's really easy to figure out the income. Where it gets difficult is when someone is self-employed, especially. And we always see in those cases that their tax return income might look really low. In fact, it might look a lot lower than what their expenses are, as shown on their financial statements. So something's amiss there, and we have to figure out what is the right amount of income, what income level does this person actually have that's available to use for child support.
Yeah, and so you wouldn't think it. Point.
I'm sorry.
You wouldn't think it would be that difficult to agree on income, but it really is one of the hottest spots that people get very contentious about, you know, because it's their income. And just understanding, and especially we have a lot of people now, especially here in New England, in this part of, you know, in Massachusetts, we have a lot of the technology companies, the publicly traded companies that are doing stock options, RSUs, and all that. So that's another element of income. as well as bonus and commission. And those types of incomes are the ones that we're also concerned about with people who are self-employed, because how we handle those income is, that income is very important as well.
Yeah. Nice. So it's an interesting point that you brought up earlier, David, about how somehow the income that is stated on a tax return during a divorce proceeding ends up to be lower than expenses. So I suppose that some of that is because there is a tendency for expenses to go up during divorce, but it's also about how they determine the income, isn't it?
Yeah, it's less about expenses going up in divorce than it is about people minimizing their income level so to avoid a heavy support order. Now, not just that. I mean, the minimization of income for tax purposes in many situations has occurred throughout an entire marriage. People are always looking to pay as little as possible to the federal government, and they can do that in a bunch of ways. You can have, like, if you're not self-employed, you might take deductions, different kinds of charitable deductions. There are lots of ways that people try to add expense. You might create some business, alleged business expenses, and sneak some things in there as expenses that really are personal items. For someone that is self-employed especially, they are always looking, many people pay their mortgage out of their business and write that off. They pay their cars out of their business and they write that off. They pay their cell phones out of their business and write that off. But those things, that may be okay for a tax return, or it may not get noticed. It may not be legally okay, but it probably is going to not get audited. But for divorce purposes, there's kind of a big private audit of what people are calling expenses. So in the child support guidelines, the new ones are really good at elucidating and explaining what some of these concepts are. I really have to give credit to the task force. They did a great job in the language and in the commentary to help explain what some of these concepts mean. But with regard to people who are self-employed, the guidelines say self-employment income doesn't start with the tax return. It doesn't start with the Schedule C or the business, or the tax return for S Corp or an individual entity or a partnership. It starts with looking at what are the actual expenses the person incurred to generate income for the business. So if a person writes their car off, they might show $20,000 a year as a write-off, but the person works out of their home. Well, the car is strictly for personal use. The same can be true of cell phones and technology and things like that. So for divorce purposes, what's on a tax, what people get away with for tax purposes doesn't really even matter.
Right.
And if you wrote off $20,000 for auto expenses that were really personal, then when calculating someone's income, that $20,000 is going to be added back onto their income number, their salary number, or their wages number. And that's going to therefore boost their child support amount.
Yeah.
And there are many, 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 I mean, I've worked with many self-employed people. I actually love looking at self-employment cases because people are really creative and it's actually really easy to figure out. So yeah. You just have to take a look.
Well, that's part of the thing that Chris and I do. We do a lot of the forensics, quote unquote, forensics to go through that and looking at bank statements to see what is actually being written through the business. Yep. And like you said, I've seen some interesting ones, but the ones that people, that is the most common example is depreciation. So if you have a company and, you have some business equipment or something that you're depreciating, that can be significant. And the first thing I do, I'm looking whatever schedule I'm looking at, that gets added right back in. So that's kind of what we're talking about for people to understand is when you you are allowed to take depreciation to reduce your taxable income, but in divorce for support purposes for both child support and alimony, we are given the leeway of adding it back in.
Yeah, and almost every judge is going to add it back in. So that's a really important first look because that's a legal tax deduction, right?
Yeah.
But it's not legal for divorce purposes. So right. It's interesting. I was just going to say the other place that where depreciation expense really comes in and it's becomes a very significant issue is if a person has rental property, right? So even if it's just one, you know, they own a second house and you rent it out, or someone has a few apartments or a few condos that get rented out, for tax purposes, the government allows you to take what you originally paid for that property, divide it up, I think, by 20. I don't know exactly what the
27 and a half.
27 and a half. So you divide that up, and every year you get to take that 127 and a half as a deduction, as a tax deduction.
Yeah.
So and that reduces your income for tax purposes. However, that depreciation deduction, which I've seen as high as $15,000-$20,000 for some property, that depreciation deduction isn't money that actually comes out of someone's pocket. That depreciation expense actually stays with the family. It's like a secret bank account. Mm-hmm. And so that will get added back in to the taxable income level for the purposes of support. And a lot of lawyers, I mean, you know, let's face it. I think, Chris, you and I have said this many times. A lot of divorce attorneys really aren't very good with numbers, and especially when it comes to taxes. So it's really important to have a CDFA like Chris and Diane, financial expert, look at the tax returns, and they could tell you right off the bat, oh yeah, this gets added back in, that gets added back in, or we've got to take a look at this expense and that expense. So really important to work as attorneys and as clients going through divorce. It's really important to have a team that at least includes your attorney or your mediator and your financial expert, because it's all about the money, and it's only really the experts that know how to manage that.
So in the case of depreciation that we're talking about, depreciation is a legal expense. There is nothing wrong with it. It does affect cash flow. So if you take the depreciation, it reduces your income for tax purposes, and therefore you need to add it back in and for divorce purposes. But basically, and it still works in the favor of the person taking depreciation, because all you're adding back in is what you have deducted, right? You're not adding back in additional taxes that you might owe because of that. But what about for—
Well, not so fast, Chris. All right, if I can jump in on that, because that's a really interesting, that's a really, really interesting point in the new child support guidelines actually mentioned. So let's say that someone's taxable income is $100,000, but they have depreciation of $20,000. So if you then consider, if you add that $20,000 back in, and you then consider that person has $120,000 in income, then the child support guidelines is going to go up considerably. Mm-hmm. However, as Chris said, people aren't paying taxes on that $20,000 depreciation. And just like if in addition to the $20,000 depreciation, they had another $20,000 for an automobile expense that wasn't a business expense, well, that gets added back in. That person actually has $40,000 in available cash that they wouldn't otherwise have based on their tax return. Now, that's great. That's $40,000 that's available for child support, but the child support guidelines and alimony go by gross taxable income, not after-tax income. And as we're discussing, that $40,000 we just mentioned is really equivalent to after-tax income. That's 40 grand in the pocket of the person, that the payer. So the guidelines allow for, and a savvy financial advisor and attorney would advise and argue to a court that $40,000 should be adjusted upwards to reflect an equivalent amount of taxable income. So it might take $50,000 to generate $40,000 after tax, for example. And so if that's the case, then the amount of income could be 150 instead of 140. And that's absolutely legitimate. It's totally in keeping with principles of law and the principles of child support and alimony, but it's rarely, rarely done.
Yeah.
So David, how much would it cost in terms of legal expenses to increase, in the example that you gave, to increase the income available for child support from 140 to 150?
Let's see. So I would say that would cost about $80, because all I have to do is add about a 20%. If I'm going to be generous, yeah. I would just add 20%.
It's because if you propose that it needs to be done, then your counterpart will say, no. And then you'll have 20 hours each of legal expenses.
I see your point on that. That's true. it can create an argument, but I think the beauty of the language of the child support guidelines is that it talks about adjusting for gross taxable income. So if the attorney on the other side is experienced, then they've seen this before, and they're going to know you're right. And so it's in most cases, it's worth making the argument and then seeing where it goes. I agree with you, Chris, though. If you never want to spend $100,000 to make back 20. So, you don't want to spend $20,000 to make back five. So there's always a practical consideration when a person makes an argument for and takes a position about what support should be.
Right. So another thing that's interesting about depreciation in particular when it comes to real estate, right? Yeah. So anyone who has rental real estate will take depreciation.
Yes.
And they would be fools not to, because right. when they sell their property, they have to pay something that's called depreciation recapture.
Yes.
Right. And a depreciation recapture applies whether or not you have taken the depreciation. So in other words, take the depreciation. Right. But the depreciation recapture, what it does also is that it effectively reduces the value of the property. Right. And that affects the asset division, which we're not talking about today. Right. But it's a point about how everything is related. Like how much happens on child support versus alimony versus asset division and so on. Right?
I agree with you. I've taken the position that depreciation is a real expense in cases. I mean, you're right. It's not a cash flow issue in the immediate year, in the moment where you're taking it. But it does have an impact ultimately that is economic and that is detrimental. So you know, you can get into some very sophisticated thinking and arguments about this stuff. But I think on a practical level, judges are always going to add back the depreciation, because that's about as, you know, they can't think it through any more deeply. And what you said, Chris, it's really, you know, if someone's going to keep an asset that's going to be subject to that tax down the road, that capital gains tax, you got to factor that in the asset division. I mean, I always tell clients, have your CPA or have your CDFA do an analysis of the capital gains tax liability on this investment property you're going to keep. And we're going to try to deduct that from the value right now. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to account for that. It has to be accounted for. And again, it's something that a lot of people miss. And but that's why you're doing this podcast, Diane and Chris, yes. to share your knowledge, but to educate the public, because the more we all know, the better we all are.
So anyone out there who has a rental property and you're confused about depreciation recapture and depreciation in general, you need to give someone here a call.
Yeah, and real simply, if a person's going to keep a property, a real piece of real estate, and they know they're going to sell it at some point, then you also should know that you're going to pay a tax when you sell that property. And if it's your primary residence, then you may or may not pay a tax, just depending on a number of factors. You need to know what you're getting into. You need to have that analysis done by a professional.
So there we go with depreciation.
I think we killed depreciation.
I think we killed depreciation. Cut this take through that.
Tell me if I talk too much. I get excited and I roll. So feel free to cut me off.
So let's move on to variable income. So for people who have a fixed income, like say a W-2 income, it's pretty easy to figure out what child support should be. It's a little bit more difficult when people have variable income because by definition it is variable, right? And so variable income can include things such as bonuses or commissions, or you mentioned self-employed people or business owners and so on and so forth, right? And so what do the guidelines say about how variable income should be treated for child support?
They don't say anything about it. Not a word. And I just reread the new guidelines word for word, and it's not mentioned. So this is always
the only thing. Let me just interrupt you. Where what it does say is that it is listed as a source of income. Let's just make sure that the public knows out there that bonus income, commission, there's a whole list in Massachusetts of 30 different sources of income used for child support. And all those incomes are listed on there. So
absolutely, Diane.
It's income. Correct. It's definitely income, but it's not addressed as to how to calculate it.
So I have a current case right now where someone had variable income last year. They got a PPP loan. And for the, it's a pandemic relief loan for people who don't know. And the other side wants to have that included as part of income.
Well, you know, if it's a forgiven loan, if the loan is forgiven, then it's not going to count as income for tax purposes, my understanding, but I think it can be counted as income for child support purposes.
But it is just a one-time thing.
Well, but it depends, right. It wouldn't be an amount of income that would carry forward in a permanent child support order. But if they're arguing about what the child support amount should be for the year that that money was received, then it should be included. Now, income that comes periodically and unpredictably, you know, like little extra money, that's generally not going to be included in ultimate child support order. But if someone regularly receives a bonus, or even could be money from an estate that comes in periodically, you know, year by year, those amounts, that if they're consistent and predictable and anticipated, then those anticipated amounts absolutely can and most likely will be included in the income calculation for a permanent child support order.
We're
all have variable income because of the nature of the work we do. We're all self-employed business owners. And what that means is that our income can be one level last year and a different level this year and a different level again next year. Right. So that makes it sort of difficult to figure out child support, isn't it?
It does. Diane, were you going to say something before I respond to that?
I was just going to say our typical scenario that we have is someone that has a base income. So we, you know, there is a known and it's, you know, that's, we can verify that by their pay stub. But like Chris was saying, they have a bonus. You know, it's typically the bonuses that I, you know, see a lot. And just so we don't get really in, you know, too complex here, what I like to do is separate them out. I like to have like a tier one. So we have, because we're able to calculate child support very easily on the known amounts. And then, you know, if, because the person who's receiving that bonus always says, well, I'm not going to get that next year. Well, you know, we know that they most likely will. but just, you know, it's on an as if and when received basis if they get it. And so in what I typically like to do is separate that out and say, okay, when you get this bonus next year, then we agree to a certain percentage of it, you know, based on the child support guidelines so that that income is captured as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's generally how it's done. So there, if you negotiate a divorce settlement and 95% of all cases end up in a negotiated settlement, in other words, they're not decided by a judge after trial.
Right.
So when you negotiate a support settlement or any settlement, The idea is that you want to create something, an agreement that lasts a long time, that doesn't require you to go back to court to change it in the future, and doesn't require the two people to be entangled financially. You know, that lets them kind of go their separate ways as much as possible. So in a situation where you didn't have a negotiation like that, you might get a child support order based on the person's income in that particular year. And let's say that they had base salary of $200,000 and a bonus of $100,000. So they might get a child support order based on $300,000. However, what happens if the following year that person only makes $20,000 as a bonus, or they make $300,000 as a bonus? Well, in a typical court case without a mechanism to make adjustments, one of the parties has to file a new court case and go back to court and fight about the income all over again. So and that's expensive, it's time consuming, it's stressful. So people are really incentivized to come up with a permanent solution. And so the best permanent solutions are along the lines of what Diane mentioned. Let's say that the person paying support has a base income level of $200,000 a year, and their bonus might range from $100,000 to $500,000 a year, say. Let's give it a big range. The best way to solve that, to avoid all the future court, is to calculate the child support amount first on the basis of the $200,000 base income. Okay. And that becomes the weekly amount that gets paid. And then when the payor receives their bonus, they have to report that in writing. And this is all in a court order. It's all in the agreement. And very often it's the agreement will say that the payor will then pay to the recipient. Maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 15% of the gross bonus. The gross taxable amount. In divorce, we work with gross taxable amounts, not take-home pay.
Yes, we do.
And so that way, you have this mechanism. So the person that's paying will pay more in years when there's a great bonus, and will pay less in years when there's a lower bonus. And all the boats rise and fall based on the variables. And that can be the fairest, cleanest way to do it. Courts tend to frown on issuing court orders that have a percentage approach.
Yeah, I know.
And there's case law about that. They can do it. They can do it. But it's a difficult problem. And the reason is, and tell me if this is too technical, but child support is supposed to be based on a certain level of lifestyle. And it's not intended to equalize income between the parties. And it's not necessarily intended to create two households that have the exact same level of luxury, so to speak. So sometimes if you just do a straight percentage and the bonus 1 year jumps to $1 million and it never been anything close to that. And this is also particularly true when it comes to alimony. Then paying a straight percentage on a bonus that's extraordinary in 1 year, would likely fall outside of what the law would consider to be really the fair, equitable approach. So that's the rationale, and that's applied especially in alimony cases. So what people can do is there's a solution to that, of course, because people have dealt with this. And the solution is that you can negotiate a cap on the amount of bonus income that will be included, or you can negotiate a limit on the amount of support that will be paid.
But David, on the bonus. A quick second. Isn't that automatically done in the child support guidelines? Because now the first $400,000 of joint income is considered child support. So you have that automatic cap that is built in.
Yeah, but so if you have an automatic cap, but that doesn't mean that there can't be child support on income above the 400. Yeah. So if the income level of the two people combined exceeds $400,000, then the court, there's discretion about whether to order additional child support, or there can be child support ordered on the first $400,000 and then alimony awarded on the income above that. And so, the income above the $400,000 is rarely going to escape notice. It's going to come into play in some way or another, and a court's going to consider it, and the parties are going to have discussions about it and decide whether, to what extent it gets counted.
Right. I think it makes sense, though. That's what the way that I've seen it, the way that I've tried to make it happen, to have the amount in excess of that limit, which used to be $250,000, is now $400,000. Yes. Considered for alimony, especially for the unusually high variable income, because it makes it cleaner. Mm-hmm. You don't have to recalculate the child support over and over and over again.
Yeah,
it is. It is. And I think the point of making it cleaner, it ties back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is that, you want the divorce agreement to take care of future legal litigation, right? You really don't want to litigate going forward. Once your divorce is done, you want it to be done and move on with your life.
Exactly.
To either creating the cap or saying that there's no support paid on income above the $400,000, whatever you decide, I think the financial advisors and attorneys and mediators really need to keep what I call the culture of the post-divorce world in mind. I mean, what's going to be healthiest for the two people who are fighting over money right now? What's going to be healthiest is that they don't fight over money in the future.
Right. Now that's why I always say, sorry, Chris, but that's why I always say it's really important that the language in the agreement gets written in such a way that the people can understand what they're supposed to do, that they have an action plan year after year of how to go about doing this. And if it's not clear, I always go by way of example, as I know a lot of agreements do, because you have to be really very clear on how you're going to calculate this income on a regular basis. And then the other thing too, is that it has to also say that the person has to supply the appropriate documentation, whether that's the W-2, the year-ending pay stub, because the year-ending pay stub is the only thing that really breaks out the different types of income. The W-2 doesn't break it out. You need that year-ending pay stub. Just here's how much the bonus was. Here's what the RSU income was. Yep. That's the only way to get a really good idea of all the different components of that person's income. And if those things, if the other party, the recipient, doesn't have language in there in that agreement for them to get that information, that creates another problem.
It does.
I think really the reality does. Is that most agreements don't have that language in there.
They right. don't.
Well, I make sure they do.
Yes, but you're not most.
Yeah, we have to. It's truthfully, I think it's malpractice not to. And the other thing you mentioned, one of the secret sauces of this, Diane, is the year end pay slip, right? There is so much information in that little one page piece of paper.
Yes, there
and
is.
It might as well be the code of Hammurabi. It's almost impossible to decipher, to the average person. I mean, God, there's some abbreviations and some anagrams and crazy things on that payslip. But if you have your CDFA, take a look at it, or a knowledgeable attorney who knows how to read these things, it's a treasure trove of information about income.
Yeah.
Because there are, and one thing that really gets overlooked a lot is that, the amount of a company's match on a 401k, like on that payslip, you might find that the person from whom you're seeking child support put $20,000 into their 401k in 2020. If you look at the payslip, you might also see that their company matched it dollar for dollar.
Or it is a profit sharing plan and they put a bunch of other money.
Yeah, right. Even better. I mean, it's like profit sharing plans, the employee doesn't contribute, but the company just throws all kinds of money into it. And, and that will be on that year-end statement. When you just look at the W-2, it's just a number and you can't break it out. You don't really understand it. And it's easy to make up excuses for why it's so high.
Right.
When you look at that payslip, you can see that the company threw all kinds of additional benefits.
And
maybe
by the
there's
way,
an automobile allowance.
Right.
You know, many things.
That thing about the retirement accounts is especially important because when a company puts money into your retirement plan, a company match, or is it a profit sharing plan or whatever it is, right? That really is income. Even though some of it, like so for instance, for a cash balance plan may not appear on a W-2, right? It is actually income. And I can tell you that 95% of attorneys in this state don't actually consider that. And you might be the exception. You're the other 5%.
But no, you're right. I mean, and I'll tell you the truth. I don't always look to count it as income. And sometimes I argue against it. And here's why. I mean, I think, you know, it's arguable. And I think it's, you know, you can, but it's important to throw in and include in the discussion. The reason, and this is the reason, this is my rationale for not including it, is that yes, it's, you know, money deposited into a retirement account, especially if the person's very young, relatively young, you know, years away from retirement age. It's not money that's accessible to that person, sure. You know? And so it's, you know, the child support guidelines talk about money that's available to use for child support. You know, money that's available to use for family support. So, and I'm gonna segue into a more sophisticated topic, K-1 income, right from this. So, yes, someone may be enriched every year by the amount of the company match, but it may not be money that they actually have to use for support. So, it may create a cash flow hardship to count that for support. Now, it doesn't mean you, and if you make that argument and you prevail in that argument, it doesn't mean that that in the asset division discussion, right, the growth, the tremendous extra growth by 100% of that person's 401k account should can be factored into an asset division. You know, so, you know, you can think forward. What are the person's opportunity for acquiring assets in the future? Well, look, their company throws in 100% of their contribution into their plan. So you can negotiate a better deal on the asset division, instead of maybe income.
So it does be recognized for that.
Yeah. So you have to know to look for it. You have to discuss it because it's going to benefit your client, whether it's on the asset side or it's on the income side. Yeah. So important to understand that. And then RSU gains are also listed on that year-end pay slip. Mm-hmm. I have a client, she had $70,000 in RSU gains this past year.
Yeah.
That's a big kahuna. And that money is available. You know, RSU money is available.
Yeah, if they sell, the reason why that money is appearing on it does appear separately on a W-2 sometimes if they put it in that one box. But you're right, it is on the year-ending pay stub. That income appears when the RSUs vest and they turn into company stock. Now, they don't actually get that money. It appears on their W-2, they're taxed. They don't actually get that money, but if it is being used, they would have to sell that stock in order to
but
get
they
that
can.
Money.
But they can sell it.
Yes,
they
can.
They have access to it and they've already paid the tax.
And trust me, they don't want to do that. And that's one of the biggest, hardest conversations we have with people. And we're like, they're like, but what you mean I have to sell? I'm like, yeah, because that's income.
Yeah. You do. RSUs, I think people are stuck with as income. You know, it's sufficiently liquid. It tends to be substantial.
I think it works in particular for public companies.
Right? Yeah.
That's RSUs and stock options for public companies are relatively liquid once vested.
Right.
Where it is harder is when you talk about private companies.
Like we won't go down there.
Startups or other private companies where people get stocks of some kind, equity of some kind.
Yeah.
Right. So how does that count in your mind?
That to me, that counts as assets, like I always look at that as part of the asset that is to be divided. So if a person has, And the number is something like this, 100,000 shares in the private company, right? They're on paper, they're worth like a third of a cent each or something, you know, like they're not worth anything until the company sells, and it may or may not sell. But when it does, then that, you know, you're entitled to a distribution. Both sides should be entitled to a distribution from that. Yeah. Just this past year, I've seen nothing come of those, but just this past year, what I would say was a very middle-class family ended up realizing $970,000 from these private equity interests, in a private company that surprisingly was bought. And so that changed everything for this family. And, you know, had they not negotiated to divide that, then one person would be extraordinarily wealthy and the other would still be, you know, struggling to make ends meet. And so it's a big deal. It's a very big deal.
So again, that's your as if and when received basis. So that's, you know, anything like that.
I think we need to explain as if and when, because I don't think the public necessarily knows that. Diane, what is as if and when
received? Well, again, in the case of this, in these privately held companies where you have these tremendous amount of shares, and the only way they're going to get anything is if the company goes an IPO or they're bought out by someone who's going to pay out on those shares, because they're now buying the company. So you're receiving it if this happens, you will get a portion of it. When it happens, you will get a portion of it. And I'm not quite sure what the as is, but as it
is. I'm thinking about this. I think as and when are redundant.
Yeah.
What is the as? I don't know.
So I don't know. Well, the if is if you get it, and the when is when you get it. So if you get it,
we'll just say must be Latin or something.
I don't know.
As is an action, and when is a time. So right. I guess they're very, it's like space time. And I know now I'm really getting far afield talking about the theories of relativity, but I apologize for that.
If you receive it and when you receive it, that separation agreement better address it.
Right. Yep, absolutely.
So getting back to an important topic, which is us. So we are, we have our own businesses, so we don't get bonuses, we don't get stock options. We don't get RSUs, any of the kind of stuff, but what we do get is income that is variable. It changes from year to year. And so how would you apply a child support calculation to people who legitimately, like us, have variable income and many other people out there?
Yeah, there are a few different ways of handling that, Chris. I'm speaking in the context of a negotiated agreement, which is 95% of all divorce cases. So if people want the cleanest way out, you know, then they might just agree on a number. So if your income 1 year is 100,000 and 150,000 another year and 122,000 the third year, and that is a fair reflection of generally what tends to happen. Maybe there'll be an occasionally terrible year and an occasionally great year. Then one way of doing it is simply by averaging the past 3 years income or the past 5 years income, relatively recent time period. That is, as long as that time period is reflective of what you might anticipate, you know, your business model might look like going forward. So you might, if you average those three incomes and do a calculation of child support based on that and come out with a number, you might just say the number is X and there's no annual variation and no annual adjustment. And both people live with that. Some years it might be good, some years it might be bad, but it creates a clean break with a reasonably foreseeable amount of support. And a lot of people are happy just like, you know what, let's just do this. A variation on that theme. And so the other thing to remember is even if you do that, the amount of child support that's paid is never set in stone.
Right.
It's always, always, always by law subject to being modified in the future. So let's say that, Chris, in your hypothetical divorce, you paid child support of $800 a week, and then you had a terrible year where you were sick. God forbid, right? But you had a terrible year. Let's take it away from you personally. The economy crashed. No one made any money. Nobody called you for work. And
thank you for not killing me.
Yeah, no, I know if I killed you, then there would be life insurance, and that'd be a whole different topic. So I didn't want to go there. You could, if that happened, even if you had an agreement that said you were going to pay $800 a week for child support, you could seek a modification, because you have then suffered a substantial and material change in financial circumstances. And the same thing would be true of the other parent. If they had a sudden decline, a substantial decline in income, they could seek a modification. If one of you had a real huge boost, and the other person heard about it, and let's face it, kids usually tell, and we're talking about child support, then they could seek a modification upward in that case too. So what we tend to do is, in my agreements, people tend to want to have, you know, where the income variation is along the lines you described, Chris, they want to have a set number, but they want to have a right to take a look at it voluntarily without fighting in court in the future. So they might negotiate a provision that says that no more than once a year, if one person requests, then the two parties will exchange financial information, including tax returns and current pay income. And then either one may request a to change the child support. Mm-hmm. And we'll often build in an out-of-court way to do that, either through mediation or through, you know, joint calculating the child support guidelines and talking about it. And you can submit, if you agree on a change in the amount, then the parties can submit just on paper to the court a joint request for modification. You won't ever have to go to court. The court will approve it, you know, administratively, and it's easy. So that's one way of dealing with that. The other way is that you can require people to exchange tax returns every year, you know, or some other period, and you do a recalculation. And then when you do the recalculation, you change the support amount. So
I've also seen it where you can say if there's, because that material change in circumstance is a very gray area, and that's also another area. So you can say if there's material change of circumstance in a percentage, you know, if someone, if it goes up by 10, 15, 20%, then that's that we consider that a material change in circumstance.
You can. And the only kicker to that is in a negotiated agreement, you definitely want to frame these future modifications in terms of a material change in circumstances.
Right.
You don't want to waste time on small things because, you know, like a relatively small bump in income is going to result in dollars, you know, in the change of the child support. But the case law in Massachusetts is you don't even need a material change in circumstances to change the child support amount. And I think that case came up 5 years ago. I forget the name of it, but it's around 5 years ago. And basically the court said is that whatever, if you recalculate child support guidelines and the change is and the amount is different from what you're paying now, you're entitled to a modification.
Exactly. So, yep.
You know, it's like, yeah, nobody wants to do that though. It's too much heartache and stress and expense. So, wanted to make it clear that I just wanted to be legally, technically correct about that point.
Didn't that case also say that you didn't even have to go to court for that? That if your child support guy came up differently, you could just submit it and it was a done deal?
You can just submit a joint petition for modification. So it's if people just agree between themselves to change the child support, and they even if they send each other emails about it and put it in writing, it's not going to be legally enforceable.
No, you have to.
Someone, I think it's a little bit beyond what we're trying to address here, but I think it's worth probably putting down specifying for people that if they want to have their child support or alimony for that matter changed, that it needs to be done through the court.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. You can do it outside of court, but you have to submit.
You still have to submit it.
Work to the court and get and have that turned into a court order. It can be done very simply if there's agreement.
Yeah. So like I always go back to my own divorce. I was divorced back in 2009 with, you know, child support and everything. And in our agreement when there's this thing, you know, when we had two kids, and when my oldest graduated from college, child support was going to be reduced. Yep. We had it written in there, and it was, it was in there. It told us a very specific way how to do it. We did it, and we submitted a form to the court. It cost $50, I believe.
Yep.
Exactly. I filled it out and we submitted it, and it was done, and that was it. And it became, right. It became a court order because it was submitted and signed by the judge at that time. Yep. So, and we did it. We didn't have to hire attorneys. We didn't have to go to court. It was $50 done.
Again, it needs to be done through the court for the public here. You just need to have it done through the court.
Right. Exactly. Which is what we did.
Absolutely. But you know, because you're a superstar, Diane. So can you talk a little bit about fun stuff like income that is an exchange in dollars, if you will. So I have a case there where there is this guy there who does who participates in several barter groups. And so he exchanges services for other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And theoretically, it is income, because theoretically what should be happening is that the service that he exchanges should be paid in dollars, and he should be paying the other person in dollars also, but they don't do that, right? And then you have things like that. You have in-kind compensation. I think we addressed the trust issues before, but there's a number of things like that that are not really strictly addressed by the tax code.
Correct. And so there's a couple of really good examples in political news, and that is that there's and this came up in the context of potential tax fraud, where an employee was given a place to live, an apartment. And
do you have a case in mind there in New York City, maybe?
I do have a case in mind. And and there's actually a Massachusetts case from a number of years ago where that's exactly what happened, is that a family owned a restaurant, and the son was making $275 a week, but he was living in a family home for free, and he was given a car. And the court said that the value of the rental value of that home and the car and some of the other things that were being paid on his behalf, that's all income. And those amounts were calculated. They were added back into his added on top of his $275 a week, and he paid child support based on that amount. So yeah, I mean, people get all kinds of benefits. They might get tuition reimbursements and all kinds of things.
So I think I can see the argument from the other side, but it's just mom and dad sharing a bedroom, basically.
Well, it was a little more than that in this particular case, but it was his house, effectively his house. So he wasn't a roommate, just a roommate in one bedroom. So it had a little more value than just that.
Sure.
So Chris, can we talk about attribution?
Attribution. That sounds like a fun topic. Actually, there are two fun topics in that realm. One is imputation, which I think we have addressed sideways earlier, and then there is attribution.
Okay.
So, which one should we start with? Attribution.
Yeah, let's start with attribution.
So what
that seems to be the most common one, and the one that is typically the hardest to apply.
Yeah, it is. So attribution of income means that if a person is not working and they could, they're able to work and they just don't, or if they're able to work at a certain level, let's say that a PhD nuclear scientist has decided when the divorce started to go get a job at Home Depot, then then the court doesn't have to use their actual income as the amount for the child support. They can consider their potential income, and the court will, and that's called attributing higher income to the person because they are either unemployed when they don't have to be, or underemployed often deliberately or you know, strategically.
So we're saying that a person who's making 60K at Home Depot could be making, say, 250K in another kind of a job. And so we're saying he should be making 250K, and that's what we're going to count as income.
Yes. And so, yes, the $250,000 would be what the court uses as the number in the child support guidelines to come up with the amount that should be paid. Now, for attribution, there's a little problem of proof there. And as Diane said, it's hard to apply. Excuse me.
Especially when you talk about PhD scientists, because I know that very closely because I have a son who is in that kind of a situation. But the pay for a postdoc with a PhD in physics is going to be less than the person who's working full time at Home Depot.
Well, then I think I may have used the wrong example. So I was thinking more like a Nobel Prize winner level.
We understand your point.
Yeah. So, but thank you for, I appreciate being educated about the pay scale of incredibly brilliant people. So, so it's fine for someone to say, look, he's a nuclear physicist. He was working for,
Raytheon
missile company and making, you know, $250,000 a year plus benefits and bonus. And they were flying him all over the world to speak at conferences. And now he's just working at Home Depot now that he got divorced. And that's fine. Okay. That's the first step. You got over the threshold. But now what you have to prove to get an attribution is that there is work available for this particular person in a reasonable area at that pay scale. So it's you actually have to, it can't be speculative. You have to prove that there's actually a job available. And that can be very, very difficult.
Possibly,
and if, you know, if the dollars are significant enough at stake, then you can afford to hire an expert, a vocational expert who can do the research and can do an analysis and all of that.
Yeah.
In the typical case, generally what we see is someone that's not working. It could be either party. I mean, it could be the new child support guidelines make it clear that the recipient of support can be attributed income, mm-hmm. not just the payor. So if you have let's say the recipient's always been the stay-at-home parent. Mm-hmm. Kids are now in high school. They're never home anymore. They're very active in their activities, and the whole work week is opened up to this person to actually get back into the job market. So if they don't want to go back into the job market, that isn't necessarily going to be the end of the story. And, you know, it can become a question of, well, how much could this person reasonably earn? And what the courts generally tend to do for someone who's been out of the job market for so long is just do 40 hours a week at minimum wage or at, you know, some amount above that, something you could get at Whole Foods or Starbucks or something like that, where getting hired is readily available. And the court might just attribute income at that kind of a level. It amounts to something, but the other thing to understand is that you can fight on the principle that this person should be working more. Yeah, and that may be absolutely true and worth fighting for. But then you have to think about, okay, what if this person was making $50,000 or $60,000? How much would that reduce my child support? And when you actually plug the numbers in, sometimes we find out it doesn't make a big difference in the child support amount.
Small scale of beans.
Yeah, it might not be worth fighting for. You know, it might not be worth the dollars. It might not be a good economic decision to fight too hard over that issue, particularly if it's trying to fight between someone making attributed 20,000 a year or 30,000 a year or even 40. So again, you know, this is the thing about what we do. It's a practice. We're not mathematical in our approaches. We may be in how we derive information, but we're not mathematical in our advice because we have to consider the practical real world impact of the advice that we're trying to give people. What does it cost them to be right?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about imputation. So how is imputation different from attribution?
Yeah, so attribution happens when someone is either not working or is grossly underemployed. Imputing income happens when someone actually has income, but they're hiding it. And that's the best, simplest way to put it. It could be someone that gets paid under the table and isn't reporting that income on their tax return or on their probate court financial statement. It may be someone that gets those benefits, you know, a free place to live, like, or a free car, like we discussed before, Chris. It can be somebody who's cooking the books in their business to make it look like they have way more expenses than they actually do, business expenses. So in an imputation situation, the money is actually there in the family, but it's being masked. Okay. And so in those situations, like the court will impute higher income. You know, that you might, if you figure out that someone is claiming $100,000 in business expenses that are really personal, then an extra $100,000 might be imputed to them as income on top of their salary. And then it could be taxed up. It could be grossed up for tax purposes as right. well. So that's the difference between attribution and imputation.
The okay. one thing I want to make a comment here, David, is it sounds like these two types of things really may not be able to be resolved in mediation or some other out of court scenario.
I don't agree with that at all.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
No, I don't. So you have to have a savvy.
Imputation in particular, the person who is on the other side of the imputation has a really big stick, is that they can turn them over to the IRS. Yeah. And that will create a whole world of different trouble for them.
Yeah, so the thing, but that person may also have signed the tax returns. And so everyone's at risk and they might have to file an innocent spouse case. But the thing is, in mediation is kind of, or private negotiation, is kind of a perfect place to resolve those things. Because if the case goes to trial and evidence of tax fraud is presented to the judge, the judge has a duty, a legal duty, to report that to the IRS. You don't want those cases to go to trial. Nobody does, right? Because the person that's going to receive support doesn't want their high-earning spouse to go to jail, right? Or have to pay $1 million tax bill because won't be able to get support. No. So in the private setting of mediation or a collaborative law case or a representative negotiation, people can be honest about what is and what isn't there. And they can figure out a way to create a fair amount of support, make a compromise, and present the final package to the court in an agreed upon way, in a way that is both accurate and safe. So I think you have to have savvy parties. That are willing to do it and understand the risks and the benefits.
Well, that's David, the key.
Yeah, David, we're coming to the end of our time. So very quickly, if you don't mind, our guest last week, Fern Froland, suggested that it may be justified to calculate alimony first and then child support. Mm-hmm. And she suggests that the child support guidelines essentially encourage that. Any thoughts?
Yeah, they do. The child support guidelines has the new ones have language about that, which was really everyone in the divorce bar was looking for clarification. You know, can we calculate alimony first and then child support? You know, do we have to do child support first? And the task force answered that question. And what they said was, in some cases, it may be equitable, it may be fair to calculate alimony first, and then add the person that's paying the alimony would have the amount of alimony deducted from their income. And the person that's receiving the alimony would have the amount of alimony added to their income. And then a child support calculation would be done. Now, why, in what kind of situations might this be appropriate? Well, it might be, the guidelines say it's even appropriate in cases where the income of the spouses is less than $400,000 a year. In other words, even if you fall within the presumptive child support limit of $400,000 in combined income, in appropriate cases, you can still do alimony first.
And I'm going to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
But cut me off. Yeah. Basically, it's just something to consider, and we need to calculate those things.
One real quick thing. In shared parenting plans, where incomes are relatively equal, that's often the case where the person that the child support is going to be really low, and the two households are going to could have very disparate income. So in those cases, especially, I look at alimony before child support.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
So for everyone watching, so I need to remind everyone that circumstances are different for everyone, and that a podcast like this one cannot replace a consultation with a professional with your specific information. I also need to add that for those who are viewing from out of state, what we talked about was referring specifically to Massachusetts guidelines and not necessarily things that apply to your state. Right? Yeah.
I just want to say, David, that was great. You know, what a great conversation. These are the conversations that we really need to have, because we really, like, you know, do a deep dive into these things. And maybe you can come back and we can continue this, because it looks like we can go on for longer. So we need to wrap it up. And
I'd love to come back. I love talking about this. It's fascinating to me.
Awesome. Great.
All right. So everyone out there, please join us for our next episode next week, Friday at 11 a.m. And I forgot again, what was our topic? I know it's child support.
We're talking about, I don't know, child support.
We'll check it out, no problem. Oh, I think it was business income. It was business income. And we have Dave Consigli, who is a CPA, who will come and talk to us about business income. So thank you again, David. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Goodbye for everyone.